Concerto number 21 in C major.
Yeah.
Yes. This was my father's. He fought for this country. Africa. Egypt. France. Italy. He died a week ago and there was 10 people at his funeral. You know why there was 10 people at his funeral? Because he was only a white, working class man, so he didn't matter. He didn't bleed matter. I'm sorry. You're sorry?
Yes.
I was going to kill a song reporter. I am going to kill a song reporter. But meanwhile,
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network, and this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker on May the 21st, 2014. And this is Wotan's Day, Wednesday, Dave Lane's favorite day. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Our big website is resist.com. And you can leave a message at our bunker number. In fact, I'm putting an outgoing message on there again. And that is 574-267-5036. And then we have the longer message up on 559-670-1473. And also you can send your snail mail to that P.O. Box 401. And we'll respond. You know, you'll sit and watch a bit of the news or hear it on the radio, and it sort of kicks off something in your brain. This morning I was watching just a little bit of Chicago TV, listening to the Black KKK report, and there was two guys drowned in Lake Michigan. I mean, Lake Michigan pretty cold right now. It's a little too cold to be doing much swimming in it. These two guys went out there, and probably one was drowning, the other tried to help, and he drowned too. I found out they're from Morocco. They've been here 10 years, and they've married, probably white girls, and got kids. And so there you go. They've spawned, and now you're going to take care of them. The welfare system is going to take care of them. But the main thing you got to remember is that the biggest share percentage of aliens being allowed or brought into the country are brought in by churches. Almost every church in the country has an immigration policy. And they're bringing thousands of them in. So the State Department got into the act. I don't know how far back they did, but they do their share too. But the Christian churches are bringing them in like mad, setting them up in your town, setting them up on your block, setting them up in business. I was to an auction about, I think it was a year or two ago, and there was a preacher in there bidding on a house for illegal alien Mexicans. Yeah. You see, Christians are very selfish people. They believe by doing these good, so-called good works, they're actually bad works, they may get to go to heaven. Whatever, wherever in the hell that is. And if they don't, they're liable to be punished and have to do a backstroke in that fiery lake that goes on burning you forever. Took a Jew to figure that out. Another thing I was thinking about was, I'm sure there must be Jew groups around that are helping import people, but probably import Jews. But I don't think the percentage is that high of Jewish groups they're running around importing. Now, they have, due to their alleged liberal way of thinking, a lot of them, they have promoted the idea of open borders and things like that. But most of the time, it's the Christians, State Department, and so forth, that's out there bringing them in. Now, these people all think this is a wonderful thing. They're doing a good thing. God's pleased. Well, there's no God, so he can't be pleased. Jesus will be pleased. No, there's no Jesus, so he can't be pleased. Mary, she, the Queen of Heaven, is she pleased? Well, she can't be pleased because she don't exist. So all this, everything going on, it's almost everything that's rotten today, has religion behind it. The Christian religion, the Jew religion, the Islamic religion. I won't pick on some of the Asian religions because they don't seem to be they don't operate like the Christians do. So our main problem is Christianity, which was invented sort of by the Jews. Of course, the Jews picked up a lot of hodgepodge of crap, mysticism before them, and put it all together and came up with Judaism, and then Judaism morphed into Christianity. And, of course, once it became a state religion with Charlemagne and so forth, it was off and running. The virus, this sickening virus, was all over the place. So anyhow, I don't know how this coming struggle is going to work its way out, because you got all these Christian fanatics, and a lot of them are racist, that's for sure, but which way is the mop going to flop when it comes to that time? Probably the way they did with the Indians, the so-called Indians, the Mongoloids out west. Half of these Christians wanted to kill them all, and half of them wanted to save them and put them in white man's clothes and get them going to church and marrying into your family and the whole bit. Yeah. So it's going to be a mixed bag, and people are going to be shooting at each other everywhere. You know, I write quite a few letters to the local paper, and most of the time they print them. I can't be quite as out and out with it as I'd like to be, but I use code words and I get right to the edge, and usually they print them. And hardly ever get a negative letter back. I got one yesterday. I was thrilled to death. Somebody's going to take me to the woodshed. And the letter was totally full of bullshit, and really half the letter didn't have any real connection to me at all, but he called me a charlatan. A charlatan. Me, a charlatan. Can you believe it? So I had to look it up in a dictionary, because when you don't use a word very much, charlatan, you don't hear it very much. And I looked in the dictionary, it said, a pretender. Well, I don't think I'm much of a pretender. And it says a quack. And a quack. Mountebank. So pretender, I guess, is the first definition of what this guy says I am. Well, what am I pretending to be? I guess if I pretended, I'd pretend to be a nice Christian boy here, interesting in saving souls and bringing people into the country, bring them into town, set them up with business and the whole bit. I guess, to me, that would be pretending. Anyhow, charlatan. That's a cute word. I think I'll send a letter back to the paper and sign it Tom Charlatan Metzger. Yeah. I should look up here what quack is now. I think I know what quack is, you see. You know, a bad doctor is a quack. Well, I found quack here. It says, the cry of a duck. How did he get that? I'm a quack. A similar harsh, flat sound, like a duck. I don't go around like a duck. What's he talking about? Number two, a false pretender to medical skill. Well, I never did that. I'm not a doctor. Don't pretend to be. But then he goes down, I guess here it says, make a noise as a duck. Fraudulent quackery. Deceptive practice. Well, am I deceptive? Do you detect anything in my speech that tends to be deceptive? I can't see where it would be, because most of what I say doesn't advance me monetarily. And I haven't been to the Switzerland to ski, and I haven't been able to get enough money together to go down to the Mississippi River and gamble and things like some people do. I don't know. I guess I'm going to have to look this boy up and talk to him. But I'm always thrilled when I get an attacking letter, because there's a whole lot of people follow me, like my letters, in town. And when somebody attacks me, they get pissed off. And when I go into the, you know, go around town, people say, yeah, what the hell's that guy? Who does he think he is, Tom? I said, I don't know what the hell he's talking about. Okay, I got something here last night. Actually, early this morning. You know, nobody seems to understand what a horrible situation things are in South Africa since the international bankers traded it off. You know, that's all that happened in South Africa. One elite corporate bunch traded it off to another. And in the process, they had to make the Kaffirs down there, the Negroes, the niggers, feel like they'd really had a revolution. Well, things are getting pretty bad down there because their GNP has fallen to less than, I think it was Nigeria. Can you imagine? South Africa had a fantastic GNP, defense, everything. Beautiful place. And now, after all these years and the blacks are going crazy, there's whites, see, they're going to repatriate back to South Africa. Well, they better think about it, because this was on a black show this morning. It's about conditions in Africa and the thousands of rapes that go on weekly, monthly, I don't know. Talk about guys sitting on the bus, sitting on the streetcar, masturbating right in front of people. They get out of jail, and the first thing they want to do is go rape somebody to reassert their manhood because they've been raped in jail. Let me play this for you. I think you need to hear this. You know, sometimes you can get more frank information out of a black radio show or speaker than you can out of a white one. You don't hear the whites. There's no big articles about this problem in South Africa. When's the last time you heard about this total explosion of rape in South Africa?
And the death sentence has been abolished. This is one of the most underreported crimes. We're talking about 1/4 of South African women who had been raped, but only 1 in 25 report that to the police. So to discuss this, and to discuss a particular project which I thought was quite fascinating, that is addressing the issue of rape and violence, we have with us Ms. Gillian Goodwin, originally from Botswana. She is someone who has a background in social work, and specifically she has a bachelor's degree in social work as well as a postgraduate diploma in public health from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. She's worked extensively with HIV patients and has worked not only in Southern Africa but in other parts of the world. And what Ms. Goodwin did is that she ended up becoming the executive producer, and I'm saying ended up because the story itself is quite fascinating, became the producer of this project and film, the Rape No More project. Mm-hmm. So with that, I just want to introduce Gillian Goodwin.
Welcome, Gillian.
Glad to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, Bill. It is a true pleasure to be here. Unfortunately, you know, when I think about the subject of rape, it's, you know, just such, as you said, it's a sensitive topic, and one that I just could not shy away from. So thank you so much for having me.
It's absolutely our pleasure. Why don't we just jump right in? What, before we go through the stats and everything else, I'm interested in, what was it that inspired you to take on this project? Now, describe a little bit of the project.
Okay. So I lived in South Africa for about 3 years. During this time, you know, I worked on an HIV project. But during this time, I would drive to work every single day, drop my son off at school, drop him off, and I'd see these newspaper articles that would describe, you know, a baby being raped, a grandmother being raped, and it bothered me. But the one article that did bother me, that just jumped out at me, was 144 rapes every hour occurring in Cape Town. And then when I read the article closely, I was like, one in 25 women in the Gauteng province where I lived reported a rape. And to me, that was just appalling and horrific. And I'm like, how is it that I live in a community where, yes, I'm not from South Africa, but I'm a woman within a community that is allowing this to happen, that it seems like it's normative? Because I was part of that society that was just driving by and seeing the statistics, doing nothing about it. So I got home and I, you know, put a Facebook article on and I said, you know, how is it that we can live in a society and say that this is acceptable? How can this possibly be acceptable? And what surprised me was the people who responded to my Facebook post were two gentlemen. No women commented, no woman said anything, but two gentlemen. One was a 25-year-old South African poet who said, you know, what are people doing about it? What is the government doing about it? And another one was a filmmaker actually based out of North Carolina who then said, you know, I'm a father of two boys and this is just really not okay. You know, what are we doing about it? You know, and I actually said, why are we as individuals constantly pointing the finger towards somebody else do something about it? Why don't we, just the three of us, if you game, let's do something. I was like, I have in my, you know, on my Facebook, a poet and somebody who does documentaries, a film producer. So I said, we could do an artistic documentary. Mm-hmm. And they actually were on board with it. They said, yeah, absolutely. Within a weekend, we had come up with a concept of, you know, we were tired of seeing horrific articles in newspapers. We were tired of seeing documentaries that have done amazing work, but that were talking about rape where somebody wants to turn off their television set. Because it's so horrific. Nobody wants to deal with it. Nobody wants to talk about it. So we decided to do something that was kind of culturally appropriate and that looked back at how can we tell a story that doesn't make people want to turn off their television. So we coined it as, you know, mm-hmm. artistic documentary.
And if you could speak, just speak up a little bit.
Okay.
And so what exactly, so the Rape No More project, It's a campaign, at least on the site it says it's a campaign, but it's also a film, correct?
Well, we had, it is not going to be a film, it's just going to be a documentary, a short documentary that we are hoping would evolve into something bigger, into a movement that, you know, different communities within South Africa can actually take this into their own communities and talk about rape. And we figured we could have it as a documentary that is put on air in local South African broadcasting studios, but that is taken to the home because a lot of rapes, about 90% of rapes or of rapists, or let me go back, about 90% of women who are raped know their victims. And these are people who are, you know, uncles, fathers, brothers, cousins who are raping these women. So if we can take it to the home where people can actually talk about it, and it's done in a lighthearted way, in an artistic way, and bring it more to the forefront where people can say, you know, this is true, this actually happened, instead of having a victim talk about, you know, her experience or his experience, it is brought more into a dramatic effect.
How do you explain why this is happening? I mean, that's what I'm trying to understand. When I was in my visits to South Africa, I would hear about this as well. And as you indicated, a lot of people didn't seem to want to talk about it. But the scale of it was absolutely frightening. And I was trying to figure out, well, why is this? And one of the things that you said to me separately was that many of the rapists think, seem to honestly think that that rape is not violence.
Right. Well, you know, Bill, why it's happening, I think that was, for me, a driving factor to understand the root causes of rape. I don't think we can address rape and why it's happening without understanding the root causes. And I think there's so many within South Africa from, you know, pre-apartheid. I mean, South Africa is known for its violence, right? A lot of people are like, oh, I'm too afraid to go to South Africa because it's so violent. But I lived there, and I've never been, you know, a victim of violence. And I enjoy South Africa immensely. But there is a strong history of violence. And I think understanding, you know, why people are raping or being raped and why it's seen as a norm is something that I think will take many years to uncover, because there's so many different segments and reasons as to why people rape. When you look at the number of people who are incarcerated in South African prisons for basic petty crimes, you put somebody into a prison system for 6 months. Within that prison system, they get raped. When they come out, you know, chances are, and statistically it's been proven, if they've been raped in prison, they're going to come out and want to assert their manhood, and they will find a victim to rape. So the root causes are many. And, you know, it's not a sexual thing. When you look at how many babies are being raped right now in South Africa, I mean, there's an infant rape that is occurring in South Africa that just chills my blood. Where babies are being raped as a cleansing ritual for people who think that, you know, if I rape a baby, a toddler, and, you know, or I rape a virgin, or I sleep with a virgin, and the younger the victim, the better, I will get cured of HIV. And this is a phenomenon that you would think would, over time, decline, but it's on the increase. And I'm saying would decline over time because as people get more educated about how HIV actually works and that there's treatment available, you know, you would think that people would actually learn and not do a certain act. But it seems as if in South Africa, the infant rape is on the increase. So there's several factors, several root causes, and I think each of these deserves a certain address. You can't, you know, put a blanketed response and say, stop rape, we're going to put everybody in one category. It doesn't work that way.
When you showed me a clip from your documentary, there was one particular piece that I found really fascinating where you staged an assault there was this woman, and this is all actors. This woman was walking, and these men were harassing her, and it was so powerful, so well done. And part of what struck me was how few people intervened. And in one case, if memory serves me, there were some people that seemed to think it was funny.
Yeah, right. So what we did with this was we had flash mobs where we took, we wanted to see how, you know, you always read in the newspapers where people are like, you know, somebody just watched someone be raped, or you see it on social media. People will tweet about a horrific crime. And it's okay, you were holding your camera while you were tweeting about this. Like, how does that work? So we enacted something. We took it to three different locations within Johannesburg. And we had three different responses. One, you know, was where the same, I think it's a clip that you saw, was a woman was being assaulted. And people actually egged on the assault. They were like, oh, yeah, no, go for it. Absolutely, you know. You know, you may want to do this to her, or you may want to do that to her. So it was just very fascinating. And in another place, people just ignored it. They didn't know what to do. They, you know, sat back and they just watched. One of the townships in Alexandria, actually, the actor almost got beaten up, and we had to intervene. But it just showed a very varied response that we were receiving. And I think that is what I was trying to say earlier, is that you cannot cookie cut it. You can't say that, you know, one size fits all in the response of rape, because the root causes are so varied. The communities are so similar yet very different. And, you know, that passing by, I mean, I think that that's what motivated me, is that how could I, in my own car every single day, just be driving to work and back and seeing the headlines as if I'm not seeing them at all and not acting.
Except the problem is, as you and I once discussed, that there's this, you, as an outsider, you don't know what quite is going on, and you have to be trained somehow
right.
on how to respond to such a situation. Otherwise, you can find yourself in a real mess.
Exactly. Exactly. But, Bill, that is why I'm saying, you know, the interesting thing with this documentary is taking it back home.
Right.
If we could even just show this documentary on people's television sets, where at home, you know, people can start talking about it at home. Because it's happening at home. Behind our closed doors, it's happening. You know, and the interesting thing, what we did with the documentary was we did focus group discussions where we were looking at male, female, and societal responses to rape, and how women in society have, you know, basically said, if I'm a young girl and I tell my mom, oh, I've been raped, how a mother covers that up for the protection, for the bigger, you know, for the common good, or for, you know, maybe father's the one who raped me. And it's seen as okay, not necessarily okay, but you don't talk about it because we'll lose the breadwinner. We will lose, you know, what is it that the outside world would say? The humiliation, the victimization. All of those are compounding factors to the fact that we're not looking within. One of the poets, actually, he is an amazing poet. He wrote a poem that was addressing why men rape. But in it, he actually ended up accusing all men of rape. And he said, he got the content from focus group discussions, and he basically said, by the fact that we as men can stand by and watch a woman be assaulted, watch a woman being gang raped, watch a woman being, you know, treated in a way that is not acceptable, a way that you wouldn't want your daughter to be treated, he called all men rapists by virtue of them watching and not doing anything about it. Similarly, we did the same thing with women, where we were like looking at what is it that, you know, why is it that our mothers and our sisters and our protectors are not standing up against rape? Because we're turning a blind eye, and it starts at home.
There's a quote from Nelson Mandela that your words make me think of from The Long Walk to Freedom, where he says, over and again, I saw men as bright and talented as my companion resort to crime in order to make ends meet. While I do think certain individuals are disposed to crime because of their genetic inheritance or an abusive upbringing, I'm convinced that apartheid turned many otherwise law-abiding citizens into criminals. I'm wondering, you know, when you talked before, spoke before about the violence in South Africa, are we talking basically about the violence that was generated through the apartheid system, or are we talking about something else, either in addition or as opposed?
I mean, I think it's both. You know, when you look at what has happened in South Africa, apartheid, you know, is still... In as much as apartheid was abolished, the scars of apartheid are still real. And, you know, when I think, you know, when I read about what was happening, like even to women in South Africa who had been raped during the apartheid era, a lot of them would never report the rape because by being seen at a police station, they would be put as an informant. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So that fear is still alive today. To say, if I go and I report it, the culture of the law enforcement from apartheid era is still very much alive. It takes, I mean, this is only a 20-year-old, it's a young democracy, it's a 20-year-old democracy. And for us to assume that things, you know, after 1994 were okay and are okay right now is naive. So the violence is still there. People who were fighting, you know, the anti-apartheid struggle are still very much alive. And, you know, many that were born in 1994 only could vote now. And they still remember. You know, so these, the scars are there, the violence is there, the anger is there. And like I said in the beginning, this is not, rape is not sexual. It's a power issue. It's, you know, it's what people, you know, it's the psyche behind it is so complex. And each rapist, I believe, does rapes for various reasons. And their exposure, their experience in their upbringing, in their societies, are varied. It's very much of what Nelson Mandela was saying. What pushes somebody to do something?
Let's go to sort of where do we go from here. Well, one of the responses is certainly what you and these other colleagues of yours have taken up. And I'm curious about what else is being done in response to this plague. Is there organizing going on by women's groups? Are there organizations that are focused on men and sexual violence? Is this being increasingly discussed in the South African media? What's actually happening?
Well, that's a good question, though. I think, you know, they have to train people up. The police are struggling. You know, the correction facilities are still struggling. It's like trying to play catch up with a system that is, you know, has these great laws, but to, you know, to try and get them all to play together is a challenge. So the systems and the strengthening of those systems, referrals, and even a victim understanding, you know, if I've been raped, basic things like that. If I've been raped, what do I do? Where do I go? You know,
if someone wants to know more about the situation, and if they want to know more about your campaign, where should they look?
Honestly, with our campaign, it's rapenomore.org. We need to update once we have the documentary is being edited currently. Once it's been edited in its final stages, we'll have it online for anyone to view. So it will be rapenomore.org. I think even if you do any Google search on rape in South Africa, there's an amazing amount of information. If you do South Africa Medical Research Council, you'll find a lot of data on rape in South Africa. And, you know, any of the newspapers, Lead South Africa, which is one of the media organizations that are doing a collective sources of media that are actually doing some great work in terms of educating the public about rape, and, you know, different organizations that put into Lead South Africa. If you just Google Lead South Africa, you will find a lot of information on organizational groups, articles that have been put on print. And so, yeah, there's a lot of information out there.
Let me ask you, this may sound like a strange question, but you were mentioning earlier in the interview you lived in South Africa for 3 years, and you have a great love for South Africa, which I share with you. The security, there was a friend of mine a few years ago that was thinking about moving to South Africa and with his family and chose not to, in part because of this issue of rape.
Right.
And I was curious, in your everyday life and in the everyday life of the women that you interacted with, how much of a presence was this plague of rape?
It's there every day. It's every day. One of the young actors in the documentary was actually, soon after we were done with the documentary, she was on a bus, and she witnessed a man basically masturbate in front of her while looking at her, broad daylight. So, you know, she got off at a stop that was not her stop, just for her own safety. She's like, I need to get out of here. Another girl also had a recent experience where, you know, somebody was rubbing up against her. So it's real. You know, it's every day, it's there. It's in your face. I think anybody who chooses to move to South Africa needs to be, it's like any place you go, even here in the United States, you have to constantly be vigilant, you know. South Africa is a beautiful country. Its people are amazing. But yes, you have situations where you can't turn a blind eye and just say, "Well, I'm okay. I'm you know, this is fine." I never used to go out at night in South Africa unless I had, you know, like several backup plans.
Mm-hmm.
Like I knew who I was going with. I knew, you know, if I'm going out at night, what my route had to be. I would never stop at a traffic light that was red at night. And living like that is not great, yeah? Nobody wants
right.
to live in fear, in constant fear. So you can imagine people who don't have, you know, say the security that I had. These are common women and girls in South Africa who have to use public transportation and bear witness to, you know, somebody masturbating publicly and looking at them. Like, you know, the minute I get off this bus, he's going to target me. That was how she felt.
That's true.
So.
Well, we're basically out of time, and I want to thank you very much for taking this time.
You know, it's amazing how they will still try to blame this on apartheid. When apartheid, obviously the blacks were all in the black areas. And so if all this rape was going on, it had nothing to do with white people. And, of course, it was probably almost impossible to police every little shack in that areas. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's part of the Negro nature. They can't blame it on the fact that they were slaves here in the United States or whether they were working in the mines in South Africa. It's part of the Negro makeup. Just the primitive part of his makeup to rape anytime he gets a chance. I'm talking generally about the race, not specifically at every black person, of course. But it's amazing how they can't come to grips with that fact. They will not admit it. They will use all kinds of excuses. And it gets worse and worse and worse in South Africa. And our American press does not talk about it. It's the whites in the press will not talk about it because they want you to think, "Oh, apartheid's over. Everything's wonderful in South Africa." Well, now they're investigating VA hospitals all over the country. Yeah. About 6 or 7 new states. Looks like it's a big, big problem. Big problem. I hope you remember a few years ago when they found the Bethesda Naval Hospital, the big hospital down there in the East Coast, and how rotten it was and how dirty it was. Yeah, they should have kept investigating. Why do these crooked politicians spend so much money just to get a seat in the Senate and the Congress? This guy is wondering. He's wondering.
A Senate worth $20 million dollars from the state of Kentucky. Why would someone invest? Why would someone put that kind of money up just to become a member of the United States Senate? And if you'll recall,
duh,
a couple of years back when Carly Fiorina tried to unseat Barbara Boxer, I think it was Fiorina versus Boxer out in California, that in the state of California, that seat was worth, or it was valued at, $50 million of dollars. Might have even been more per. You know what? I think it was $100 million. I'm thinking old school. $100 million per candidate, meaning that the seat is worth $200 million. So if you add the 20 and 20 together in Kentucky, that means a Senate seat in the state of Kentucky is worth $40 million. Well, that's what the people that so desperately crave it think it. Think that it's worth. This is an irony because why was the 17th Amendment drafted? How many of you people know the history of the 17th Amendment? 17th Amendment was drafted because allegedly there was too much pot, there was too much money that was being showered and thrown at, bribes were being thrown at U.S. senators. And they were being thrown at U.S. senators by members of houses of representing across the amber waves of fuel. Well, Mr. Hibiki It does a pretty good job of running down the history of the 17th Amendment and all the things that it was supposed to cure. And just going down the list and ticking them off, going, yep, didn't cure that one. Yep, didn't cure that one. That's still a sickness. Yeah, that canker sore is still throbbing out there. So I think it's still worthy of discussion. Although, and for those of you that are despondent about the lack of Tea Party victories last night, look at it this way. The victories in 2010 and 2012 failed to stop the increases in the debt ceiling. They failed to stop Obama from starting wars on his own. Failed to stop Obama from kill list. They failed to repeal Obamacare. They failed to not defund the Affordable Care Act. And look at all the things that were supposed to happen that didn't. Or that people wanted to happen and did not. And then you should be able to see the stature and the size of the endeavor and just how large it is and how insurmountable of a hill that is to climb. Might be as tall as, what was the mountain in the Grinch that stole Christmas? Was that Mount Crumpet?
Well, that mountain is so high, that mountain, and call it corruption, so high that it's totally nobody can climb over it. The corruption has reached the point of total self-destruction of the system. And everything's simply bought. Everything. Bought. I mean, the people that still go out to vote must be a little insane. Well, let's go over to the Ukraine and see what's happening. The U.S., CIA, NATO have stepped up their military operations and continue to actively wage their secret war in the Ukraine against the Ukrainian people. In an extremely dangerous, poorly planned operation that is failing and carries with it the real threat of sparking off a full-fledged war, if not World War III, against an unwilling Russian Federation, which continues to attempt to deal with the aggressive, in-your-face threat to its security through diplomacy and peaceful means. The recent capture and killing of 25 CIA officers in Ukraine only shows the desperation of the U.S. effort and the complete disregard for not only international law and the people of the Ukraine, but also for the lives of their own CIA personnel. Yeah, that's right. The facts are as follows, backed up by dozens of reports, eyewitness statements, and visual evidence. On the 18th of May, the people's mayor of Slavinsk, his last name is Ponomarov, announced that Kiev-controlled troops and law enforcers had sustained heavy losses during a so-called counter-terrorist operation in the east of the country, unquote. At least 650 servicemen were killed, wounded, or taken prisoner in the past 10 days, he said. There are 70 foreigners among them, and of these, 13 agents of the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation and Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, were killed, and 12 others were wounded, he told reporters. The mayor also said that the self-defense forces inflicted heavy losses on right sector Ukrainian army forces and also completely wiped out the junta's Alpha operatives. According to media and television reports, the mayor, Ponomarov, stated that with regard to the foreign mercenaries in the ranks of the Ukrainian executioners, they also suffered losses. According to Ponomarov, a private military company, Airline Z, Sistema Bartlomy, lost 6 people. Greystone lost 14 people, Academy 50 people, CIA and FBI lost 25 people. of which 13 were killed. Furthermore, killed or injured 40 soldiers of the 95th Air Mobile Brigade of Ukrainian Armed Forces, as well as 20 members of the MUP, Luhansk militias, from May 2/12. 8 were killed and 3 wounded. Yeah. The Voice of Russia also reported that the CIA denied the claims on a Twitter post, which of course is to be expected. The U.S. Central Intelligence Agency has denied reports of a number of CIA agents actually killed in clashes between forces loyal to the Kiev authorities and self-defense units in the eastern Ukraine. A CIA official claimed on the U.S. Embassy in Berlin's official Twitter page of that no such incidents had taken place and that allegations by pro-Russian activists did not correspond to reality. Plausible deniability is a phrase coined by the CIA itself to describe the withholding of information from senior officials in order to protect them from repercussions in the event that illegal or unpopular activities by the CIA became public knowledge, unquote. Due to the fact that the denial comes through a Twitter post and not from an official CIA or FBI statement, or from the White House for that matter, and that the CIA-FBI is heavily involved in illegal operations in Ukraine and has been for decades, I would argue that it is a given that the CIA has lost officers, agents, mercenaries, and support staff in the Ukraine. That is almost a given. Due to the huge flow of information and the massive amounts of reports, leaks, and revelations, there's little debate in the media about one simple fact, and that fact is what is most troubling about the entire U.S., CIA, NATO, EU meddling in sovereign affairs of Ukraine. To make matters worse, the U.S., CIA, NATO, EU undeniably now have blood on their hands, not only that of the Ukrainian civilians, Tatars, and Russians, but also of citizens of the other countries. The fact that it's being ignored is that the U.S., CIA, NATO, EU operations and meddling in the Ukraine is illegal, from the overthrowing of the democratically elected government, to the shooting and murder of police, to the killing of anyone who is against the junta, to the backing and training of the right sector, and finally to the importing of U.S. CIA Greystone and other mercenaries to kill Ukrainians. The entire mission is illegal. Well, when did that ever bother the military-industrial complex? The United States of America is involved in a dirty, illegal war in a country it had no business being in the first place. The Ukrainian operation serves no U.S. security interests. It is no protecting lives, and it does nothing for the American people to advance democracy or human rights or anything else. The U.S. NATO want missiles in the Ukraine to further threaten Russia, which has done nothing but to try to be friends and simply do business. CIA operations in the Ukraine are illegal. Period. End of discussion. I will not go into the many poor, innocent Ukrainians that have died or suffered in the Newland coup and since, only to say that those who were burned alive and gassed and murdered in Odessa and other locations in the Ukraine will not be forgotten. And those responsible, whether they be CIA or whoever else, will be held accountable. This is a message mostly likely of interest to those poor CIA operatives in the Ukraine who are blindly fulfilling orders of the agency, the company, the farm, Langley, or whatever else you want to call it, and the American elites, who have abrogated unto themselves the right to send you off to die in some far-off land to fulfill their poorly, though out, geopolitical objectives and continue to propagate and wage war Cold War that they just cannot seem to let go of. Also, for all of you members of the CIA, Special Operations Group, Navy SEALs, CIA, Greystone, and Academy, and the like, who are operating in the Ukraine. I'm a humanist. I suppose that I'm speaking to the human in all of you. I understand that when you signed up and you were full of misdirected patriotism, perhaps full of prejudice and hate for the ragheads and the terrorists and the like, all you wanted to do was to serve your country and even be proudly give your life for the Constitution, the security of the American people, and for the government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Honorable motivations other than the racial hatred thing and love of killing, of course. But what will you do when you find out you have been used? When your comrades and you are asked to kill women and children to provide intelligence and support for the killing of civilians whose only crime is that they speak Russian and do not want to be ruled by criminals? How will your wives and families feel back in America when they find out you died in some field near Slovensk and your body was left there to rot because the U.S. government could not even admit by Twitter posts that you died fulfilling your mission? There is no justification for what your leaders are asking you to do in the Ukraine. There is no threat against America other than what they themselves are creating. The Russian people and the Russian government, no matter how much they are demonized, wish the American people and even you no harm. Look at Edward Snowden. He was a CIA and NSA, and Russia gave him asylum because he saw the lies and understood the truth about the illegality that he was asked to take part in. Even this certified enemy of the state was protected by Russia. I have written the world audience and my readers about what is really happening in the Ukraine for the last 6 months, trying to get the truth out to the world, and little has changed. Now I ask you directly, you who are helping the criminal junta for the U.S. government and the CIA, Greystone and USAID, and the like, stop what you're doing. You're killing innocent people, including your own highly trained citizens. I'm pleading to you because your leaders, your president, your Secretary of State, are doing the bidding of someone other than the American people. Remember who you serve. Remember your Constitution. There is no legitimate reason for you to be subverting the Ukraine. The central bankers, the military-industrial complex, and Washington elite are not what you signed up to give your life for. Russia is not your enemy. Believe me, neither is the Ukraine. Your enemy and the enemy of all of us sitting in Kiev right now is sitting in Kiev right now and in the Washington elite clubs and posh watering holes, patting each other on the back for the $1 million they made today. Or is it a billion? And for the way they have gotten you to unwittingly go along with their little plan, they must be laughing that you are prepared to die for them. In the end, you may die in some field near Slovensk or some other Ukrainian city, as you're involved in a secret operation to kill Christian women and children for the crime of being pro-Russian, and they will deny that you exist, and your body will rot somewhere in an unmarked grave. Is that what you signed up for? Think about it. Look around you. What are you really doing? Well, that's the end of an interesting article from people inside the situation and from the voice of Russia and so forth. So you heard it here, right here on Insurgent Radio. Well, this is for all you guys that want to spend your whole life defending Germany, defending the leaders of Germany. If you think the Jews are, you got a problem with the Jews, what about these people? In the latest German probe, didn't say Jewish, in the latest German probe into National Socialist concentration camp guards, investigators have identified 20 suspected former guards at Majdanek who are still alive and living in Germany. The Associated Press, the Associated Yiddish Press, Jew Press, reports that the results of the investigation by Germany's special Nazi war crimes office into more 1,000 former guards at the concentration camp would be handed over to state investigators. Are you kidding? Lead investigator Thomas Will, probably a white Aryan, blonde-haired, probably blue-eyed, told the Associated Press that about 30 suspects were identified and located, but around 10 had already died. Oh, that's horrible. Who gave them permission to die? The remaining 20 men and women all live in Germany, he said, but refused to elaborate further. Some 220 others are still being investigated for possible charges, but have not been located. It's not up to the state investigators to decide whether or not to press charges. Yet federal prosecutor Kurt Schrim, who heads the Nazi War Crimes Office, told Reuters that even if charges are filed, it's unlikely the cases will proceed much further, except to make Jews happy and other insane Germans of the present system. With few exceptions, most of them won't lead to investigations by prosecutors, he said. Although many of the suspects are still alive, their cases might not get to trial because the proof is too thin. In other words, they're probably innocent. A similar German probe last year into 50 former guards at Auschwitz, 40 of them were still alive, yielded three arrests. One of them, 94-year-old Hans Lipschitz, was charged with 10,510 counts of accessory to murder, but ultimately deemed unfit for trial by a German court due to dementia. When would that ever stop you? Why would that stop you? Don't make... Prop him up. What do you mean he can't stand up? He's on a stretcher. Stand him up, strap him to the pole. What do you mean he's got dementia? Slap him around. Throw some water on. Shoot some drugs in his arms. If his eyes wander around a little, he's probably okay. We'll get him. You see, why should whites all around the world get all upset about this when the Germans are doing this to their own people? You see, most of these people were just regular people that didn't volunteer for this. They were drafted, and they were told, go here, stand there, and do this, just like they do the guys today, or they always have with the American military. Same thing. And if you don't obey, they shoot you or put you in prison for a long time. These are working class guys that got caught up in the war, and now they want to persecute them when they're 94 years old. Don't ever go. Don't ever agree to go. If they have a draft, tell them, screw you, I'm not going. But I'm ashamed of the Germans that they would keep on keeping on this Jewish crap. And if the Jews didn't want this kind of crap to come down on their heads, they shouldn't have been involved in all the shit they were promoting World War I and other wars for profit and all the things they did in the Weimar Republic that actually caused Hitler to be elected due to Jewish operations and Jewish corruption. Had a great deal, of course, with the election of Adolf Hitler in the first place. So now you're crying. Keep crying. We've got too many other wars to worry about now. Too many other people to kill. Yeah, too many other camps that are sitting around. We got Guantanamo. Yeah, we got to do those people in. Yeah. 14-5, that's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow, Thursday, and we'll give it a go again.
Next one tells the story of a Mr. Grayson, a beautiful woman, a condemned man named Tom Dooley. When the sun rises tomorrow, Tom Dooley must hang. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Poor boy, you're bound to die. I met her on the mountain. There I took her life. Met her on the mountain. Stabbed her with my knife. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Poor boy, you're bound to die. This time tomorrow, reckon where I'll be. Hadn't it been for Grayson, I'd have been in Tennessee.
Well, now, boy,
hang down your head,
Dooley.
Hang down your head and cry.
Hang down your head,
Dooley.
Oh, boy, you're bound to die.
Well, now, boy,
hang down your head,
Dooley.
Hang down your head and cry.
Hang down. This time tomorrow, reckon where I'll be. Down in some lonesome valley, hanging from a white oak tree. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Poor boy, you're bound to die.
Oh, well, now, boy.
Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Poor boy, you're bound to die. Poor boy, you're bound to die. Poor boy, you're bound to die.
Poor boy, you're bound to die.